1756, Congregation Jesuit Israel versus Congregation Sharif Israel.
Just let everyone be seated and then we'll hear you. Thank you. All right, proceed.
May it please the court, I'm Lou Solomon. With me at council table are Deming Sherman, my colleague from Rhode Island, and Ms. Savitt, my colleague from New York. The issue on the appeal, and as to which, with the court's permission, I would like to reserve 4 minutes in rebuttal.
Yes, you may have.
Thank you. Involves these intimately related Jewish religious items, the synagogue in Newport, called the Toro Synagogue, and the bells or rimonim or finials that adorn the Torah that the district court found were essential to the religious ceremonies of Toro Synagogue, and became part of the heritage of the Jews of Newport 250 years ago. Other than the time that the rimonim is part of a mixed pair were with Sherith Israel in New York, these rimonim, these finials, have been part and parcel, integral parts of the service at the Toro Synagogue. It's Sherith Israel's position that that's where they should remain. Our position is not based on religion, is not based on equities, is not based on social policy, it is based on the rule of law, and it's that I would like to address. The district court found that although CJI, the plaintiff here, did not exist before 1893, it not only had possession of the rimonim as part of its possession of the Toro Synagogue, but the district court found it owned them outright and, in his words, could do whatever it wanted with them. The district court found that the Toro Synagogue itself was held in trust by Sherith Israel, the New York Synagogue. He found that based on use of the language for the use of the Jewish community that was in an 18th century will, a ruling we do not challenge. The same language, however, for the use of the Jewish community is in the very document that the district court found gave Jesuit Israel the right to use the rimonim.
Counsel,
yes?
For purposes of your appeal, you have accepted the district court's finding that you all acted as a charitable trustee. That was your status, at least as to the cathedral, if not as to the rimonim. But I want to ask you something, and it may be that you want to consult with your clients and reply by letter rather than doing so in court. There is an amicus brief filed in this case from the Beckett Foundation for Religious Liberty, which says that the district court should not have characterized your status as a charitable trustee, that came very close to infringing on First Amendment interests. And so my question is whether your concession is simply for purposes of this appeal, or whether it is the independent position of your client that is your status vis-a-vis both the synagogue and the rimonim.
Your Honor, we will respond by letter. I will say that from day one of the trial below, I tried to articulate to the district court that the tags, the tickets, the nomenclature that was being used didn't always fit perfectly because the relationships, these juridical relationships, were created before some of these legal concepts, and we were concerned about having the legal concept sort of wag the entire dog. There's no question, however, about the facts. The parties, CJI and the New York congregation, in 1903, when CJI lost a federal court case, surrendered the premises. And the first legal question is, did these two parties have the authority to enter into a settlement agreement, and should the court now respect that settlement agreement and enforce it, rather than saying, well, because they're religious institutions, we can, you know, overlook this a little bit. The language of the settlement agreement followed a stipulation where CJI declared without qualification title in Sherith Israel and directed the absolute surrender of the premises and the paraphernalia. The paraphernalia included the rimonim. They were there at the time. The only reason CJI ever had access, ever had possession of those rimonim, was because they were part and parcel of the religious service. And Sherith Israel's position was, first of all, there's a mixed pair up there, and to us it didn't matter if they owned them, we owned them, whoever owned them. The parties were agreeing that so long as there was a cathedral there where Jewish services were being carried out, those finials would be part of it. And CJI agreed with that. And in a formal, valid, legal, binding, recorded indenture with lease, they said that the rimoni, that the premises and the paraphernalia were being encumbered, and that failure to honor that encumbrance should lead to the eviction, not of the Jews of Newport. For 200 years, Your Honor, Sherith Israel has been protecting the rights of Jews to pray at Newport. For 250 years, since they helped build this cathedral, okay, Sherith Israel has shown every which way that we want this open to all Jews. Even the district court, in finding fault with Sherith Israel, twice acknowledged that what Sherith Israel wants is for this synagogue to be open to all Jews. At the end of the 19th century, when the congregations in Rhode Island were fighting with each other and excluding each other, Sherith Israel stepped in. We said no. We said we're only going to allow this place to continue as is if everyone is allowed. CJI wanting to be the caretaker, wanting to be the congregation that was going to stay, agreed that it would encumber the place and the paraphernalia. And the first legal error of the district court that I wish to call to this court's attention is he never interpreted those words. He should have enforced those words. We cited cases from that time period. Everyone knew what paraphernalia meant when you were dealing with a religious institution. There was press. The press knew it. Everybody seemed to know what the word paraphernalia meant. CJI also knew what paraphernalia meant because in their board resolution of February 2nd, 1903, they used the language agreeing to surrender the possession of the building, the premises, and the paraphernalia. And then there was a public surrender ceremony. The keys were given to Sherith Israel. It was locked. CJI had no access to the cathedral, had no access to the rimonim inside. It acknowledged that it was taking it back pursuant to a lease for which Sherith Israel charged a nominal amount of $1. We're not looking to make money on this venture. And the district court erred by not interpreting and enforcing that language.
If I can go back to the Beckett Fund brief, they say that while you are focusing on language about ownership and surrender and lease, they also say that the language consistently says that the parties agree to follow your client's ritual practices, and they would like us to decide this case on that narrow ground. I take it you have chosen an alternate path that relies on the ownership type language that you've just highlighted? Or have I interrupted you prematurely and you were going to get to that clause?
Our position with respect to paraphernalia was an easier ground, since the district court refused to interpret it. The district court said that Sherrith Israel understood that to mean the
personal property. But you don't want us to send it back for interpretation. You want us to interpret it.
Yes, Your Honor. Our second assignment of legal error.
But they argue, look, that was a long time ago. It's not even clear the dollar for the lease has been paid since the 1950s. And there's been a degree of independence since then. So, I mean, this is implicit in their argument. So it would be a mistake to rely on the documents from the beginning of the 20th century. Could you address that?
Yes, Your Honor. And I would like to address the Beckett Fund's position. It is exactly the same as ours. I think it's another legal error. The mode of ritual has been in this relationship since the beginning. We have been a benevolent landlord. Some people up there over the decades think we do too much, and some think we do too little. We step in when there are ritual issues to be addressed. Selling the Rimonim is a ritual violation. They agreed, not as a matter of religion, but as a matter of fact, to follow the rites, rituals, and customs of Sherrith Israel in New York. And that is the same ritual as the colonial Touro Synagogue followed, and that prohibits the sale of these. The district court wouldn't allow us to put that proof on, fearing opening a Pandora's box. So when the people there wanted to use the burial spot, the cemetery, in a way that was inconsistent with the rites, rituals, the customs, the practices of Sherrith Israel, we put a stop to it. We said no. They acquiesced. They wanted in 1905 and 1911, they wanted to add to the Touro edifice, to the cathedral. We said no, and they acquiesced. When throughout the period, when there have been major issues, when we have had to say that's not our practice, they have acquiesced up until the sale of these Rimonim. And we do assign clear legal error in the district court's refusing to enforce the language in that valid legal and binding indenture. Your Honor,
When you say that, do you mean enforce the language which could only be enforced by an interpretation of Sephardic doctrine?
No, Your Honor. I want the court to enforce the language that that the objects, as well as the cathedral, is to be used for purposes of service. Then as a factual matter, we put proof in that as a factual matter, we use these Rimonim and we do not sell them. That is what we want enforced. And that's a neutral principle of law.
But I take it the basis for the enforcement you wish there is simply a power which is given to Sherrith Israel, in effect, to deal with property. I take it you're not arguing that we should enforce it because Sherrith Israel is coming to a correct doctrinal conclusion.
Correct, Your Honor.
It's a question of power, not doctrine.
It is, Your Honor.
Okay.
And the valid legal and binding lease itself gives the remedy that not the Jews, but if CJI refuses to carry on that, then we should replace CJI. The place is still going to be open to all Jews. This old hoary 1903 document, by the way, Sherrith Israel received rent from CJI in 2012. There's no doubt in the record. We have the document. It's an exhibit. In 2012, the very year they sued us, their website acknowledges, that the district court ignored the evidence, but acknowledges that this lease remains in effect until today. So it's not a matter of, oh, it's ancient and it's old. This is about a currently valid and vital agreement. Now, the district court's refusal to allow any form of worship to get in his way as a matter of power, his refusal to interpret that then led to the error that he made in finding that we were not proper trustees. He finds that there was no self-dealing by Sherith Israel. He finds that we never had our hand in the till. What he says is that our insistence that Touro continue to observe the ritual practiced by its colonial founders has posed legal problems that linger to this day. So he was going to get rid of those, and he did. Now, the legal error there was to have found no means, no wrongdoing by Sherith Israel sufficient to remove us as trustee. Not only does he say there's nothing in the record, the district court, he specifically found that we discharged our obligations as trustee.
This sounds like you are arguing that even if he was right about their ability to sell the Rimonim to the Museum of Fine Arts, that is still no basis to remove you all as trustees. Is that really what you're arguing, or are you arguing there was error in that finding that they were free, and therefore there can be no question about our status as a charitable trustee?
The signal error is what Your Honor identified, and allowing them the right to sell was the principal error. If the court affirms that, Sherith Israel still should not have been removed as trustee, and CJI should not have been appointed as trustee in a proceeding where the Attorney General wasn't a party, where there was no notice given that any of this was happening. CJI itself said that they were contemplating subsequent proceedings before any of this happened. The point I was then making, Your Honor, though, was that having found that we carried out our obligations as trustee by leasing the building to them.
Finish.
Thank you. What he says is our single obligation is to act for the benefit of Jesuit Israel. And on that basis, he said we were not a good trustee. We have no obligation singularly to act for the benefit of Jesuit Israel at all. We act for the Jews of Newport.
Thank you.
We oppose the court, Gary Miftalis, for Congregation Jesuit Israel.
Counsel, before you really get started, I've got a question that I kind of need you. Transferring a piece of property requires a proof of ownership. In other words, for you to be able to sell what we have in front of us today, you've got to be able to show that you're entitled to be able to do that. In other words, that you own it. Do you agree that the burden of proof of showing ownership is on you?
The answer is, I could just answer it a little more lengthily. The answer is yes in part, and no in part. Judge McConnell found two independent grounds for finding that we owned the Rimonim and that they were not part of any charitable trust. The first one of which we would have the burden on, which was as follows. He found that the Rimonim were made for the colonial predecessor synagogue, the congregation praying in the synagogue, Yeshua Israel. That was an issue that they challenged below, and he found that. Indeed.
He found two things. One, that they were made for that congregation, and two, that your group is the successor to that.
He found that as the second part of that, Judge, actually, just to put a nuance on your point, which is he found that the only reason these Rimonim ever came into the possession of Sherith Israel for a small period of time in the 19th century is when the Jews left Newport, the synagogue was shuttered, they were given to them in safekeeping to be redelivered to the congregation hereinafter praying in the synagogue. He found that to be appellant to the use of the word safekeeping, redelivery, but also from the fact that Sheriff Israel treated it as a bailment, which is to say they put the words Newport on the sides of the building that were there, and also they redelivered it.
Why does any of that matter in light of the 20th century documents showing a settlement between the parties?
And that's where I'm having problems, reading the 1903 decision.
Well, the reason that matters is twofold. First, there's a lot of other 20th century evidence which goes the other way based upon the presumption of ownership.
No, the presumption of ownership doesn't apply if you've got documentary evidence that describes the relationship between the parties. So, although they didn't get into this, I don't see how the presumption of ownership either applied here or was sufficient in light of the later documentation.
Well, the presumption of ownership, Your Honor, occurs
from possession.
Yes, and from conduct on both parties' side. Beginning in 1903, we have held ourselves out publicly and repeatedly for 14 years, as the owners.
And why have you been paying a leasehold dollar?
That was for the synagogue, not for the Rimanim.
But your answer assumes that the personal property, which was referred to in general terms, is not subject to the same ownership documentation as the building itself.
And there are factual findings on that which, most respectfully, are in no way clearly erroneous. The factual findings are they contested there was a trust below. They've obviously given that up on appeal. And the trust comes from the will of Jacob Rodriguez Rivera of 1787 and admissions by Sheriff Israel over the years of the trust. And it only dealt with, most respectfully, Justice Souter, the reason for the trust was not having to do with personality. It had to do with the fact that in the 18th century, a religious institution could not own land or a building. That is why, when the synagogue was built, it was placed in the names of three revered members of the synagogue, Levy, Hart, and Rodriguez Rivera, as trustees. And in Rodriguez Rivera's will of 1787, he makes plain, we aren't the owners of this. We don't have equitable title. We're only holding this as trustees. And indeed, all the documentation over the years indicated that the synagogue was held in trust, period. That is the thing.
Why do we have to go back to that in view of the 1903 agreement, the 1945 agreement with the feds, and I think a subsequent historic preservation agreement? Why are they not, in effect, superseding documents, simply expressions of civil law contract agreement that should govern this case?
Well, in no way, most respectfully, Justice Souter, do they supersede anything. As Judge McConnell found, let's talk about this lease, which is a lease of real property on a real property form book. You can't lease or sell what you don't own. I think that's a fundamental principle of law. He made an absolute factual finding that there was no evidence that Sheriff Israel ever owned the Rimanim at any time, any place, anywhere.
No, so let's go back to Judge Baldock's question. What this case is about is whether your client may sell the Rimanim. And to talk about their burdens or what relationships they had strikes me as being largely beside the point, especially when we have this 20th century documentation. And you keep going back to history. But we're dubious that that has anything to do with this case. So let's go back to how do you show your burden that you are the owners of this, other than history?
Well, there are two grounds, Your Honor. The factual findings by Judge McConnell of a bailment where the property was redevelopment or redelivered to us, and we think those findings are clear and not clearly erroneous, and they've done nothing to discredit those findings.
The 20th century documents do not talk in terms of bailment at all.
But the 20th century documents, the one 20th century document they talk about is a settlement agreement, period.
After the federal court rejected your claim that you were the owners of the property at issue there. And so the parties, sensibly enough, reached a settlement agreement.
Are you talking about the 1903 decision?
Yes.
Well, Judge McConnell and Wade in.
Yes, and let's not go there, okay? So you have the decision. It sets up the parties for settlement negotiations. They reach a settlement that, regardless of whether there was a bailment before, it now is an agreement between the two congregations as to how this property is going to be treated. And the settlement involves a lease. And why, to go back to Justice Souter's question, why, if the lease is irrelevant, did your clients make payments all those years under the lease?
Well, they made one payment in the last 20 years. But number one, the lease doesn't cover the Rimanim. The lease covers the synagogue. Period. The settlement agreement, neither the settlement agreement nor the lease effectuating the settlement agreement ever has the word Rimanim in there.
No, it has appurtenances and paraphernalia.
It doesn't have personal property. It doesn't have personally. But also,
then what could paraphernalia possibly refer to if it is not personal property?
Well, if you look first at the settlement agreement, which is Appendix 1888, it doesn't have the word paraphernalia in there. It has the word fixtures in there. It says building premises and fixtures. That's what the settlement agreement says at Appendix 1888. And the lease was effectuating the settlement agreement. The word paraphernalia, the word Rimanim doesn't appear in there. The word personal property doesn't appear in there. And fixtures are clearly things that are attached to the walls.
And the authorizing vote for the lease says these trustees are authorized and directed to surrender the possession of the synagogue building premises and paraphernalia belonging thereto to the other congregation.
We would suggest, Judge Lynch, that paraphernalia there was used as a synonym for fixtures, period. It was not used for ruling. And really, since they drafted the lease and under Old World Settlement Law in Rhode Island and elsewhere, any ambiguities are construed against the drafter. If this were to cover the one valuable thing in the synagogue, the one thing of value, it should have said it. It shouldn't be under some nomenclature under fixtures.
The indenture uses the language about appurtenances and paraphernalia.
It doesn't say Rimanim, Judge. It doesn't say personal property. That's how you... This is...
And so a civil court interpreting the language of the parties is precluded from finding, is required to find that the women in are not part of appurtenances. sentences or paraphernalia.
Well, no, they're not precluded from finding that, but I would say three things to that. One, there is a factual finding that in drafting this lease, the judge found, as a matter of fact, and it's not clearly erroneous, that it was not the intent of Jesuit Israel to include the Rumanim in the lease. That's the first thing. That's a specific factual finding, which is not clearly erroneous. And secondly, with all respect, I go back to a prior point. I could enter into a lease with Your Honor and say, I lease Fenway Park to you. Right? But if in fact I don't own Fenway Park, that doesn't mean anything. And I think that's just a matter of principle of law. And I think most respectfully, Your Honor, I think there's a lot more also to the presumption argument, and if I might most respectfully try and spell it out a little bit, because the burden, if once there's a presumption of possession, the burden, a presumption of ownership from possession, the burden would have to shift back. Well, the burden shifts to them to rebut the presumption. And going back in answer to the very first question from Judge Baldock, all the history over the last 100 years are consistent with us being the owner and inconsistent with them being the owner. Because how people behave under a contract or a lease is some evidence of what it means. That goes to Williston. We have held ourselves out as the owner. They have never objected.
The 2001 federal agreement, the Historic Site Operating Agreement, says, whereas the Touro Synagogue is an active place of worship of the congregation, Jesuit Israel, which has possession of the site through a lease with congregation Shariath Israel as owner.
And that's only about the building. It doesn't say anything about the Rebbeim in there, in the 45 agreement at all.
All right. Could you address the separate argument made about the Beckett brief's suggestion that the narrowest possible decision has to do with the agreement that the paraphernalia and the rest would be used in accordance with the religious practices of the New York congregation?
Well, first, the whole religious issue, which is both their issue and the Beckett Fund's issue, first, in the lease and in the 45 agreement, there is a reference to how services are to be conducted, consistent with a Spanish and Portuguese tradition. That is to say, with prayers, etc. There's nothing in there in any way, shape, or form which has anything in the world to do with what one does with one's personal property. Secondly, with respect to the issue of services, they're fully aware of how Jesuit Israel has prayed for 100 years there, and indeed their only live witness said that we have no problems with how they pray there. Indeed, it sounds pretty familiar to us, and indeed, for 100 years they've indicated they know how we pray and have no problems with it, whether it is precisely the same, you know, whether prayer A follows prayer B or prayer C. Secondly, the issue of interpretive, Judge McConnell, I think, quite properly kept the issue of their attempt to say, well, gee, they may be right under property law, but under religious law, well, that shouldn't be the case. That's an Establishment Clause issue. And
I'm sorry, I thought their argument, or the argument of the brief, was that your congregation had agreed to a certain religious practice, and according to that religious practice, that there was no real dispute. You could not sell the Rimonim. Are you saying there is a factual dispute about what their religious practice is?
Yes. Number one, we didn't agree to any religious practice that precluded us from selling the remedy. Two, we do not agree, even though it's clear it's in the record, that if the judge had allowed in evidence about what their Sephardic religious beliefs were about selling property or not selling property, that we disagreed with that as a factual matter and would have contested it. And indeed, when they attempted in the middle of trial to put on this rabbi to testify to it, we indicated we would have contested it and it shouldn't be allowed because he was an expert witness who hadn't been fairly disclosed, and that's why he was precluded. But no, I think that it is plainly a factual issue. We do not in any way, shape, or form agree that Jewish law prohibits us from selling this, and nor do we believe it's in any way applicable to this case, which is a matter of Rhode Island property and trust law or federal law to the extent federal law applies. But it's a matter of secular law, this case. And I should say one thing, a couple of things in response to a couple of things that they raised, one of which that they take the position before this court that the remedy were part and parcel of the synagogue and they have to be there all the time and so on. You know, in their own complaint in the Torah, and we couldn't have the Torah synagogue without the remedy being there, in their complaint and counterclaim here, they ask for possession of the remedy and for them to be shipped to New York. Number one. Number two, as the judge found, and it's an undisputed fact, the remedy were hardly ever on the premises of the Torah synagogue. Most of the time, these Meyer's Rimini are out on loan to various museums and educational institutions around the country. For example, they're out at Yale, they're out at... they have not been on the premises of the Torah Synagogue for the last 7 years because they've been on loan and at a prominent exhibit at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. They've been on loan to the Smithsonian, they've been on loan at different times to the Jewish Museum, and even when they are back on the premise, even when they not, when they, this handful of times they're not out on loan, they're kept in a safe deposit box. They're not used as part of the, because they're too fragile and the like. And also they have multiple sets of remedy, including multiple sets of Meyer's remedy. So this construct, which is inconsistent with their pleadings, that somehow the Torah synagogue could not go on without the Rimanim, is quite beside the point. Secondly,
sorry, your time is up, but thank you.
Thank you. Your Honor, page 89, note 69 of the district court opinion, the district court does not find that CJI is a successor. He specifically does not make that finding. The 1945 agreement with the federal government, like the 2001 agreement, doesn't talk about modality of religious belief, but about use, about how religious articles are used. Sherith Israel also loans its property out for educational and other eleemosynary reasons. That's a far cry from selling them so that they're never then again part of this Jewish heritage that the district court finds they have been a part of for 250 years. In the 2001 agreement, the council may have misspoken, there's specific reference, not just to the property, but to protecting and conserving the related collections. And at trial, they admitted that the related collections include the Rimonim. The court already saw that the form book indenture, the form book lease, was not a form book lease at all. The word paraphernalia was specifically written in. And the district court never found as a fact that CJI did not intend to include personality. What he says is that there is no evidence of its intent, but there was evidence of Sherith Israel's intent, even if the court were to go beyond the plain language of the agreement, it says paraphernalia. We cited the cases from that period. That I think everybody knows what paraphernalia means. If the court wished to go beyond that and look at intent, Sherith Israel's intent was very clear. There was a dispute in 1902 and 1903. The parties resolved it. So if there was a dispute about Fenway Park and two parties decided that they were going to enter into a settlement agreement to say, I don't know who owns it, but I'm telling you it's part of this deal, we're going to keep it as part of it, that should be respected by the courts, and that should be enforced by the courts. And it doesn't have anything to do with what religious background or religious law is behind it. The question is not, what does Sherith Israel believe? The question was always, how did Sherith Israel act? And on that, my brother was wrong again, because there was unrebutted evidence, both by Mr. Katz, we cite this in section F of our brief at page 23, of the unrebutted evidence that the affirmative covenant about how the religious article should be used as part of the service was used, not used haphazardly, and not put them in harm's way, and put them in a vault if you need to. No one knew the value of these, by the way. It wasn't the one valuable thing in 1903. And they knew that they were religious articles, and they weren't going to be sold. And so the idea of putting a value on them was as foreign to those people as it should be to us today. When Rabbi Soloveitchik was foreclosed from testifying, he was not going to testify as an expert. He was going to testify to the fact of how the rimonim are used, and he was precluded from doing that.
Well, opposing counsel said he was precluded because he hadn't been disclosed.
Right, and what we said to the judge is we're calling him as a fact witness, and he had been disclosed as a fact witness, not as an expert. We were not trying to prove religious law. We were trying to prove what the Sherith Israel do.
Are we going to be able to see from the record that he was not precluded from testifying because he was not disclosed, but for the reason that you're stating?
Yes, Your Honor. There's an order that we put into the appendix where the judge says, I'm worried about opening Pandora's box, and so he wouldn't let him. Thank you.
Thank you. I must say the high quality of advocacy from both sides in this case has been demonstrated, and we're very appreciative.
Thank you, Your Honor.